You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, November 22nd, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Good evening, Evan. How are you?
That was English.
Very fine. How's everyone?
Good.
Good. What's
good.
Up?
Super.
So, Evan, November 22nd. That date sounds very familiar.
It should to people, especially in the United States and perhaps to some worldwide, because it was in 1963, on November 22nd, that the President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. He was shot twice. Second shot was a direct shot that hit him in the head, and it killed him instantly. A few days after the assassination, the new president, Lyndon Johnson, by executive order, created the President's Commission on the Assassination of President Kennedy, known unofficially as the Warren Commission. The commission proceeded with a 10-month-long investigation and presented their findings to President Johnson in a report titled Report of the President's Commission on the Assassination of President Kennedy, more commonly referred to as the Warren Report. Supreme Court Chief Justice at the time, Earl Warren, led the commission, and hence those were the names for the commission and the report, Warren Commission, Warren Report. The report concluded that there was a lone gunman named Lee Harvey Oswald, whom plotted and acted alone in committing the crimes of the day. So did you know, some of Johnson's staff at the time, when President Johnson ordered this commission to be formed, they were concerned about the creation of it because of the fear of the possibility that the findings would create more controversy rather than form a consensus. And of course, those concerns proved to be very warranted because that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I think even without the Warren Commission, though, I mean, the proliferation of conspiracy theories was going to happen no matter what.
Yeah, especially around a presidential assassination. I mean, people are going to be looking for anything that they can to come up with an answer even when they're wrong.
Did you guys know that at the time it was not a federal crime to kill the president?
They just never got around to...
Huh?
Isn't it a federal crime to kill anyone?
No. It's the state crime. You know, it's a relevant state. It's not a federal crime. So after that, they passed a law making it a federal crime, a federal offense. So you could be, obviously, in the U.S., you could either be tried, you know, in state court or federal court. They made it a federal crime to kill the vice president or the president. Probably a good idea.
But people lower than that, that doesn't matter, right?
Right. So to this day, conspiracy theories continue to exist. In fact, still a majority of the public believes that there is some sort of conspiracy. A 2003 poll indicated that 75% of Americans believe in a conspiracy. Only 19% of Americans reportedly believe that Kennedy was killed by one person.
But Steve, isn't that because, not necessarily because everybody is a conspiracy theorist as much as they just really don't know the history?
Yeah, there's so much misinformation spread about it. And just the common kind of beliefs are more pervasive than any kind of detailed analysis that would indicate that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman, which I think the evidence overwhelmingly shows that that's the case. And there is no evidence for any specific conspiracy theory. What conspiracy theorists do is just anomaly hunt. You know, they look for anything odd about the events of that day, and then they cast that in a sinister light and weave it into a conspiracy. But there's no actual evidence for a conspiracy.
I suspect it's one of those things that is also going to get worse as time goes on, just because, you know, people who were there and saw it happen, saw it unfold on the news, I think would be more likely to remember the evidence that made it clear that it was only one person, as opposed to those who are just learning about it, maybe saw that terrible Oliver Stone movie and are making up their minds based on things like that.
It's funny you say that, Rebecca, because Gerald Posner, who wrote the book Case Closed, and we've referred to it several times on the show, at the time it was one of the more definitive investigations or private books that came out about the assassination, about Lee Harvey Oswald, and it all pointed scientists and forensics and everything just pointed to the conclusions that the Warren Commission came up with. But part in his investigation for that book, he told us that when he went back to interview some of the eyewitnesses at the scene at the time, their stories had changed over time. And the reason they had known that is because he compared it with interviews that those same people gave to reporters right after the events of that day occurred, in which they expressed something different.
Well, there was that woman, Hill, who claimed to be the closest person, you know, outside the motorcade, closest civilian to the president during the headshot. She actually, like, has a calling card that says that. She was videoed at the time on the news saying, I didn't see anything. You know, I don't know what happened. Then her story evolved over the decades because she was on multiple interviews. And if you just watch every interview in chronological order, it's first I didn't see anything. Then, you know, I saw something suspicious. Then I saw a man. And then I chased the man across the street. You know, then her story got more and more elaborate over the years. And she probably honestly believed what she was telling. Just her memory.
Oh, yeah.
Slowly morphed over the years to fit the theme that, there was a suspicious figure, you know. It's actually an interesting inadvertent documentation of the malleability of memory in that way.
I don't know. And there's also the possibility, Steve, that she was doing it for the attention. And
I'm sure
that's
part of it, but it's not necessary that she knows that she's confabulating. I think she probably doesn't know that she's confabulating. Are you guys familiar with the Umbrella Man?
What's the Umbrella Man?
An email was sent to us just today by coincidence by a listener, Tim Everett, linking to a movie about the Umbrella Man. So if you look at some of the home videos taken that day, including the Zapruder film, it was a sunny day, although it had rained the night before. It was a sunny day. No one is wearing raincoats or umbrellas. There's one guy standing on the side of the street with an open black umbrella, and he is right at the point where the shots are fired into the motorcade. And it's odd. There's no explanation for it apparent from watching the videos. This is a lone guy with standing under a black umbrella. One conspiracy theorist, you know, actually went as far as to suggest that the umbrella was involved in the assassination. You know, it was a weapon.
Like the penguin.
It was a weapon. Right. Yeah, exactly, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, guy did a documentary about this, and he tracked the guy down. The Umbrella Man gave testimony before Congress as to what his role in all this was. And he said that it was a protest, that the standing there with the open umbrella, he was protesting some of the actions of JFK's father, and because of his association with Neville Chamberlain, who was famous for walking around with a black umbrella. Absolutely no
That's
way you could possibly ever figure that out. You know, oh, maybe the guy was protesting Neville Chamberlain. But the point of the video and the point of Umbrella Man, which is an excellent skeptical point, is that, and the documentary makes this, or the guy being interviewed makes this point very eloquently, is that if you look in detail, like under the microscope, at any historical event, you know, where you have access to all of the complexity of that event, you will find all of this chaotic details, these weird, wacky details, because that's the way life is. Life is full of weird, wacky details. And we tend to have this image, this like TV image of things all, you know, being sort of pristine and making sense. And
a purpose to everything.
Yeah.
Steve, clearly the Umbrella Man is clearly
right.
A time traveler.
But reality is quirky and weird. And so you look at under the microscope, under any of these events, and conspiracy theorists will have a lot of raw material to work with. There's no way you could account for the Umbrella Man a priori. It's, you know,
that reminds me of the video that Rebecca showed us, I don't remember what, about 6 months ago, of the woman with the cell phone from a 1930s black and white movie, right? Remember, like, she was holding something to her head, and it looked like the modern image of someone holding a cell phone. But, of course, back then, there were no cell phones. But she had a cell phone.
Nope, but they had hearing aid devices that looked very similar to that.
Yeah, right. The other update on the JFK assassination thing is uh, a National Geographic special that aired on Sunday.
But it's going on again this coming Sunday on Nat Geo. So people who are listening to this on Saturday, if you're getting Nat Geo, have a look for it at Sunday. Check your local listings.
Yeah, JFK, The Lost Bullet. Again, another documentary. What they did was they digitally remastered not the Zapruder film, but all the other home videos that were taken that day. And they said, you know, the Zapruder film has kind of eclipsed all these other videos, but these other videos are good
really?
And contain a lot of evidence. They're just, they don't have that nice clean shot of, you know, the headshot that makes the Zapruder film so famous. But there's a lot, especially when you digitally enhance them, you know, you guys are familiar with the modern digital enhancement. It's incredible what you can do with pictures. When you scan them in, you have them digitally, and then you could, you know, change the lighting and bring them into focus now. I mean, it's incredible what you can do.
We're getting to the point where it will be no longer laughable how everybody on Law & Order
Enhanced. That's stuff that we love. It would actually be real. So anyway, they conclude from this evidence, this other evidence, that it's consistent with the lone shooter. One piece of evidence they point to in one of the videos, there's a shot of the book depository during the assassination, and you can see a shadowy figure moving around in the sniper's nest.
No way.
There's somebody there, you know.
Awesome.
It's not a crystal clear picture, obviously. It's very low res, and but there's a shadowy figure there. And also the other bit that is sort of the critical bit was, by looking at these other videos, it's apparent that the time of the three shots was more like 11 seconds, not 6 seconds.
That's huge to me.
It's huge because that makes it much more plausible that Lee Harvey Oswald could have fired all three shots by himself.
And if you think about it, and as Gerald Posner also points out in his book, shot number one is the start of the clock. So it's really only two shots that he have to get off in what was 6 seconds, but apparently it is now 11 seconds. So extrapolate that.
It's even easier. Yeah.
I mean, it means that anybody could have had enough time to take the shot.
Yeah, and he was trained and everything. I mean, the guy was in the military, so
practicing. He has a picture of himself with the gun he used in his backyard practicing.
Yep.
You know, he probably wasn't that good a shot when he came out of, I think it was in the Marines, right? He, you know, practiced with that rifle to be able to pull off that performance.
That iconic picture of him holding that rifle on the cover of Life magazine.
Right, which some conspiracy theorists said was fake and was recently shown to be genuine as well.
Yeah, well, was it because of the shadows or like under his chin and things that didn't quite sync up with?
Because there weren't any stars showing in the background.
Yeah.
You see, and this is what gets me about the conspiracy theorists. They come up with all this stuff, but they purposefully ignore all the data and information that's been compounded over decades of analysis, independent analysis, research, using modern science and forensics and all these recreation techniques that our modern world allows us to do these days that we couldn't do decades ago. And they absolutely flat out ignore all of that evidence. So these conspiracy theorists, just their credibility is absolutely shot to pieces. No pun intended.
That's the way it works. Any evidence which disproves the conspiracy was planted or fabricated, and any evidence that's missing was hidden by the conspiracy, right? So there's no evidence that could ever disprove the conspiracy once you head down that rabbit hole. So Power Balance, bankrupt.
Yay!
Well, not bankrupt in the sense that the knee-jerk reaction of bankrupt, going out of business, never to open their doors again. They, from my research, they filed Chapter 11, which is, it's not really going bankrupt and closing the doors. It's more of protecting them.
Well, it is going bankrupt, but it's
not out of business bankrupt.
Yeah.
Just.
Yeah. So what I read, there's a mishmash of information out there. I mean, the initial report was that they had to pay $57 million. But then I read someone actually read the paperwork on it that they filed that's public and everything, and it might basically only be around $1 million. And also, Power Balance has done a good job of removing the lingo that was getting them in trouble, and they're very strongly blaming the company that was selling their product in Australia as the offending party and distancing themselves from the actual offense.
Funny they're doing it now after after all these lawsuits that didn't exactly come forward with a lot of those details before.
Because of the hard work that the skeptics around the world have done in this case, they've definitely hurt power balance and made a lot of people become aware of the fact that it is a scam and that what they're claiming is absolutely not true. But the company is still making money. They're still shipping their product. They're coming out with new products now. Their new one is a mouth guard for sports. Mm-hmm. And you could see one of their power band bracelets embedded inside the mouthpiece. Like, it looks like there's two holograms that are in there, and it looks very similar to their wristband piece of jewelry, just kind of embedded inside the mouth guard. Yeah, in the end, it's a piece of silicone that protects your teeth when you get into a rough situation while you're doing some type of sport. Okay, fine, whatever. The whole point here is that they made a product that they're embedding their same old BS product into, and that they're selling, and that they're marketing to two people that are professional athletes. And, you know, they could legitimately be selling this product that does serve a real function, but the baseline of it is based on crap. They made their money on deceiving people. And unfortunately, this is a very good example of an unsinkable rubber ducky. They got to the point where they made enough money where they really aren't going anywhere, in my opinion. It really pisses me off.
And they're not the only ones doing this, too. I mean, there are many companies that are doing this. I mean, people will be selling magic amulets like this, you know, forever. When I wrote about this, it took me two seconds to find another product that's almost identical. It's called Energy Armor.
Yep.
It's the same thing off their website. Energy Armor is a life technology designed to work with your body's natural energy field. It's the same malarkey.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They sell them at the pharmacy. You can find, you know, for like $5 now. Stupid.
This is the Cure. Remember the Cure bracelet? Well, it's the same thing. It's a magic energy amulet. Yeah.
That one's better.
That was $400.
It's a piece of metal as opposed to a piece of rubber.
Well, and, you know, if you take into account that people who pay more money will probably get more of a placebo effect, maybe it is better. Like, I paid $400 for this thing.
There's a direct correlation between the amount of money paid for that kind of stuff and...
I think it's been shown, right? We talked about that a while ago.
Well, it's investment justification. The more you invest in something, the more you have to justify it by believing that it's valuable. So the harder it is to obtain, the more invasive it is, the more expensive it is, then the greater the placebo effect. But it's just the psychological aspect of saying, ooh, I better believe this works because I've invested a lot in it.
And the other thing that it teaches the scumbags of the world is that go ahead, sell your BS product, put your crap on the label. You know, if you make enough money, you could pay any lawsuit that you're going to get hit with, and there you go. And you just keep on going.
With billions of dollars. And
Jay, I'm interested about the – because that's a pretty big discrepancy between $57 million and $1 million. Everything I've read was the $57 million dollar feature figure.
But that's – I think that they have to pay that back to anybody who says, hey, I want my $30 back. I don't know if they hand over $57 million and then somebody pays that out, or if they just have to pay back all of the customers. And if every single person asked for their money back, it would add up to $57 million. I don't know how that would work. We'd need to get more details. But I've only read the $57 million figure, but I don't know what the logistics of it are.
We need a skeptical lawyer to call in.
Yes. But yeah, the Chapter 11 certainly seems like a sort of restructuring strategy. They're not closing.
Now, from a PR standpoint, though, does the product take a hit?
I hope so. If you read the comments on the articles, the comments are mostly this product's a scam and how embarrassing it all is. You know what I mean? So they're mostly skeptical.
Yeah, though it's hard to tell it's hard to tell online, though, because, you know, we tend to see a very savvy audience online compared to, you know, your average person who sees these on an infomercial or in an in-flight magazine, you know.
All right. Well, Bob, there's a couple of updates on the now infamous faster-than-light neutrinos. So what's the scoop? Is it holding up or not?
Yeah. I knew this would come back. They just neutrinos just, you know, won't seem to go away. Which is good news, actually, because if they did go away, we'd be kind of screwed because that would mean the sun was dead.
Right.
But they won't go in the news as well because CERN has recently finished some more experiments on and confirmed their result, which took the media by storm back in September. I'm sure you guys remember that. They showed experiments that they had done that showed that neutrinos had arrived 60 billionths of a second faster than the speed of light at the detection apparatus. And everyone was just talking about it for so long and telling very silly jokes. That Jay, you retold that neutrino bar joke, didn't you, recently on Facebook?
I had to. It was so timely.
Oh my God.
It's before its time, really.
Sorry, we don't serve neutrinos faster than light here, says the bartender. A neutrino walks into a bar.
So their results gathered from like 15,000 experiments over 3 years seemed to point to a scientific crank's wet dream. It really was that these ghostly chargeless particles known as neutrinos seemed to travel just a little bit faster than the speed of light. And of course, if that were true, it would undermine modern physics. And you could even argue that if something could actually travel faster than light, then even cause and effect itself would need to be re-examined, which of course is a really huge if. It actually doesn't get much bigger than that. So what they did was they carried out an experiment called the OPERA collaboration at CERN, and that stands for the Oscillation Project with Emulsion Tracking Apparatus. So the focus, though, of these most recent experiments dealt with one specific concern that was raised by scientists, and specifically, since the bunches of neutrinos that were used in the original experiments were created by these relatively long pulses of protons, then it could cause measurement errors. And I actually hadn't come across this one concern. And
actually,
somebody had described
this on our forums after we talked about this the first time. They said this is the concern. It's that it's not like they're sending one neutrino across or one instantaneous pulse of neutrinos. The neutrinos were spread out over a period of time that was actually much greater than the 60 billionths of a second. And then they're using statistical analysis to find out what the average length of the average departure time was. So that just created a potential for error on the order of magnitude as was being seen in this study. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So in other words, so you couldn't be sure if the neutrinos detected were produced by the front or the back of this proton pulse that created them. And so to put some numbers to it here, so the groups of protons in questions were like 160 times longer than the famous 60 billionths of a second faster than light that the neutrinos were traveling. So that when they redid this experiment, they made it so that this wave train of neutrinos or the protons that created them were only 3 billionths of a second long. So it's much shorter. So it's a much tighter experiment. And they in that regard, in this specific case, and they ran it about 20 times, which is a far cry from 15,000 times, but I don't think you need to go that crazy. But they ran it 20 times, and they came up with pretty much the same result, and even with slightly higher levels of statistical certainty as well. So yeah, in that regard, it was better. For me, one of the key things is, okay, this is the new results, but what are the scientists that aren't involved? What are these guys saying? And of course, many of them are still very skeptical, as they should be. The key complaint a lot of them have is that they want to see an outside party replicate these findings. And of course, right, that's fundamental to good science. You could have all the experiments you want, but until somebody can replicate it that's not related to you really in any significant way, that, you know, you really can't, you know, take it to that next level level of certainty. Actually, Rob Plunkett who's a co-spokesman for Minos at Fermilab, he had a good quote. He said that OPERA is to be congratulated for doing some important and sensitive checks, but independent checks are the way to go. And he's so right. Another group of scientists from Italy at Gran Sasso National Laboratory, they recently said that they dispute the faster than light interpretation because anything moving that fast would have to lose energy. So that was another take that I hadn't really come across.
Yeah, that's interesting. Basically, they say if a particle is traveling faster than the speed of light, it will radiate away energy and particles until it slows down to the speed of light, which is a good way of explaining why something can't go faster than the speed of light. If it ever did, even momentarily, it would just immediately irradiate away enough energy to get back down to the speed of light.
Yeah. And these are the ones that are interesting to me, these concerns, because they just seem so fundamental It's not just like, you know, tightening up your experimental protocols. It's like, this is theoretically impossible. But I guess the point is, though, that our supposedly our theories are inadequate for these situations, and that's why this would be so revolutionary. But it also makes it so incredibly unlikely. My favorite concern, though, has to do with the use of GPS. You guys remember they used GPS to synchronize the experiment's clocks, and a lot of scientists think that this whole aspect of it needs to be vetted much more closely. So it's not like this can't, if this has to happen, then all of physics has to be upended. I think there could be these little loopholes that really, though, would not really change things as we know it. Kind of like relativity itself, where it's like, you know, Einstein's still correct, but in these special, you know, high energy, high gravitation, high speed domains, things get a little wacky. But you never come across that stuff anyway. That's why it's so counterintuitive, because we didn't evolve in a relativistic environment, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, I don't know. So, I mean, I hear what you're saying. That was my thought, too, is that, well, okay, if they are traveling faster than the speed of light, it doesn't necessarily mean that everything we think we know about physics is wrong. It just means that there's some deeper equation. There's some deeper level to things that creates an exception in very special situations. That still would be revolutionary, I think.
Absolutely. Question.
But yeah, it wouldn't make Einstein any more wrong than Einstein made Newton wrong. You know, it just was sort of a deeper understanding of mechanics.
Exactly. Another special case.
Yeah. I think that's very unlikely. I agree. I don't think that's what's going to happen.
No, absolutely.
It's far more likely that they just they made some kind of technical error here. But ferreting out that error will be very instructive, and it will teach them a lot about how to do these experiments, and maybe they'll even figure out some other little phenomenon to take into consideration. And I still find it very compelling, the notion that when we detected the supernova in one of the Magellanic clouds, that the light and the neutrinos arrived at the same time, even though it was coming from like over 100,000 light years away.
Not at the same time. It was like a matter of hours.
From 100 and whatever it was plus 1,000 light years away, that's virtually identical. That's almost at the same time.
Absolutely.
If this amount of difference would have caused the neutrinos to arrive 3 years earlier.
Yeah, years. So how do you get around that?
Well, this is how you get around it.
What?
They say that the neutrinos produced by the supernova are a lower energy than the neutrinos produced in the CERN experiments, which is true. But it's still, I think, a little bit of special pleading. It's like, okay, so the supernova neutrinos are the ones that travel at the speed of light, and these are somehow special neutrinos that we didn't detect. So it's still, again, it's not impossible. It's true. It's technically true.
Yeah.
They are at different energies, but it still needs an awful lot of special pleading in order for this not to be evidence against the FTL neutrinos.
So are you telling me that supernovae don't produce neutrinos with all the energy that we could produce here on the Earth? I believe it. I totally believe it. But on the surface, it seems kind of silly. Ah, the supernova can't do that, but we can.
Well, you know, what can I tell you? So this story is not over yet, but it's interesting to watch this unfold. It really is. Let's go on. Did you guys hear? This is a funny and interesting story that I really tried to wrap my head around. I don't know that I've completely succeeded, but the European Food Safety Authority has made the following decision. They put together a committee of like 21 experts who deliberated for 3 years in order to evaluate the following sentence. Regular consumption of significant amounts of water can reduce the risk of development of dehydration and of concomitant decrease of performance. And after...
Is it concomitant?
Concomitant.
Concomitant.
Yes. A concomitant decrease of performance. And after their thorough scientific investigation, you know, of the evidence, they determined that statement is not true. That the regulations do not allow for companies to make that statement. Essentially, that water, drinking water, can treat dehydration.
And these are the same people that we have to fight to get stricter regulations on things like homeopathy.
Right. No, homeopathy is fine, but water for dehydration, let's not get crazy.
Don't be silly.
Well,
so, you know, of course there's got to be something deeper going on here. They can't have concluded, you know, after 3 years that water does not treat dehydration. It's just, it's surreal. You know, it's really bizarre. So my immediate assumption was that this has got to be some kind of regulatory technicality, right?
Or it's in the BJM or something, and Christmas is coming up or something like that.
Yeah, it's not a joke. It's serious. I found the actual decision, the actual regulation. They say that, you know, they go through a lot of the specific descriptions. Like, we accept that water is adequately defined in the statement, and that dehydration is identified as the disease, the target disease, and no target population was identified, so we're going to assume it's the general population. So they say, dehydration is a condition of body water depletion. The panel notes that the proposed risk factors, water loss in tissues or reduced water content in tissues, are measures of water depletion and thus are measures of the disease. The panel considers that the proposed claim does not comply with the requirements for a disease risk reduction claim pursuant to Article 14 of Regulation, blah, blah, blah. So as best as I could figure out, and I did write this as a blog a couple days ago, you know, on purpose, because I wanted the commenters to, you know, to crowdsource this a little bit and sort of help me figure this out. And I think that what they're saying is that lack of water is not a risk factor for dehydration. It is dehydration. So that a risk factor was not identified. And that's why the statement doesn't hold. Because the water's not treating a risk factor for dehydration. It's treating dehydration itself, and the regulation requires that you identify the product has to treat a risk factor for the disease.
What's the point of that, though? Like, in what way is that helping?
Yeah, I don't know. That's the thing. I couldn't read. I don't know what was the point of asking them to review that statement. I don't know what the point of that decision was. I don't know why they weren't more explicit in explaining their decision.
And it took them 3 years.
Well, you know, I'm sure they weren't deliberating for 3 years. It's kind of like the thing where, all right, we'll have this meeting in 6 months to talk about this. Yeah, I'm sure it just takes that long to go through the bureaucracy. Right. But anyway, right? So, but the two professors who submitted that, there are two German professors. Apparently, they are consultants for the food industry, for like marketing for the food industry. So, were they, and I've heard some reports saying that they were primarily just testing the regulatory process to try to expose it as a farce.
Uh-huh.
But others say that, you know, were speculating that they were trying to see what they could get away with so that, like, bottled water manufacturers could start, like, making specific claims about their water, like, you need to drink our water to treat your dehydration or prevent dehydration, and it'll improve your performance, you know. So, because it's kind of a vaguey statement, like, regular consumption of significant amounts of water, that's a stupid way to say it, you know. What's significant amounts? How about adequate amounts? Or appropriate amounts? Some people thought that maybe the concern was that they would say that water hydrates you better than other things, or that you have to drink water to prevent or treat dehydration, as opposed to getting water through juice or soda or, you know, for other fluids, or even food, which is true. You can get water just from your regular diet. You don't have to specifically drink water in order to stay hydrated. So it's interesting. You know, you can look at this from a number of ways. It's on its face, the decision seemed absurd, and you wonder if the process was really appropriate to this question. You know, why are they even evaluating something so basic as drinking water to not get dehydrated? You know, it's just silly. It's like, next up, food treats hunger. You know, what's the point of it? Mm. But the other thing is, were they appropriately preventing, like, bottled water manufacturers from making dubious claims? And if not, why weren't they explicit about that? Or maybe just that the regulatory process, it's like all they could do was evaluate that exact wording and not make more general statements about the kinds of things manufacturers can say about water and what they can't say about water. But, Rebecca, you're going to tell us how the color of your dinner plate can affect your experience of the food that you eat.
I'm getting hungry already.
Well, there have been a lot of studies in the past about how color affects our food choices. When I was studying marketing, for instance, in school, it was well known that restaurants, certain restaurant studies had been done and shown that red, for instance, is supposed to stimulate the appetite, and yellow is apparently supposed to have some sort of effect like that as well, which is why you see those colors on many fast food joints. But and also there have been studies that have shown that the actual color of our food, not just the environment where we eat our food, but the actual color of our food can change the taste of it. You can probably think of several examples of weird colored foods that you've eaten in the past that didn't quite taste right. For instance, Crystal Pepsi was a gigantic flop. Basically, it was a cola product that had no caffeine and was clear instead of being brown. And what happened was people would drink it and they would think that they were tasting lemon lime, even though there was no citrus in the actual soda. They were just accustomed to seeing clear sodas that had lemon lime flavoring. And so for that reason and many others, it failed miserably.
Yeah, because cola is clear. You have to actually put food coloring
caramel
in it
coloring
to make it that brown
color.
Yeah. And like, and orange soda is clear too. They put orange coloring in it.
And tomato juice, for instance, is brown. But how many people would really enjoy drinking a brown tomato juice?
It is brown?
Yeah, because you can't keep that bright red color in a
can
in storage for a long period of time.
Oh, God, that's horrifying.
So they add red coloring to it. It's because study after study shows that people who consume something that is a color they find unnatural, they will ascribe to it certain tastes that aren't necessarily in the actual food item. There have also been studies that have shown, there have been a few studies that have shown, and I should say there have been some studies that have negated these, but there is some evidence that suggests that certain colors of food can actually make your food taste sweeter. So brighter colored food, particularly reds, are according to some studies, they actually trick you into thinking your food is sweeter. So there have been a lot of really interesting studies on the psychology of color and how it affects food for us. This one is interesting in that it has nothing to do with the color of the actual food or necessarily the environment, but it has to do with what plate you eat it on. And what they found was, what the researchers did was they gave strawberry mousse, a little dollop of strawberry mousse, to 53 people, which not a very large sample size, so bear that in mind. But they gave these bits of mousse on either a white or a black plate, and then they had the volunteers rate how sweet, how intense the flavor was, and the quality of the mousse that they were eating. And what they found was that the people who got the mousse on the white plate thought that it was more flavorful and sweeter than those who got the mousse on the black plate. And there was no substantive difference between the level of quality that was rated, depending on whether it was a white or black plate. But yeah, according to this very small study, people who got their mousse on a white plate found it sweeter and more flavorful. The researchers suggest that maybe it has something to do with the fact that the color of the strawberry mousse actually pops more off of the white, and feeding back into those other studies that have shown that, you know, for instance, that pink reds makes things sweeter.
I wonder how significant the effect was, though. Was it just a little bit, or was it, you know, I know it's a small study and they probably can't, they weren't that granular maybe, but I would think it'd be maybe a little bit, but not a lot. You know, I wonder how much it was.
All I know is that it was found statistically significant. I don't know that it was overwhelming, but it was, yeah, statistically significant.
Oh, Bob, listen to this. This is my favorite example of this phenomenon. Frederick Brochet, 2001, tested 57 wine experts.
Okay.
These are wine experts. White wine with red food coloring.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
every single one described it as a red wine.
Wow.
Not one.
No shit.
Was able to figure out that it was actually white wine.
Wow. All 57, though.
Right? Yeah, I know. They described it in like in flavors, in terms that are typically associated with red wine, jamminess and crushed red fruit. Yeah. So, yeah, completely deceiving. But this is not just the power of suggestion.
The power.
This is also a well-established phenomenon of cross-modal sensory perception that, in other words, we actually modify, our brains modify one sensory modality, one sensory perception based upon other types of sensory input. Because, you know, again, our brains assume that the world makes sense. And so it's constantly trying to tweak what we think we're seeing and hearing and whatever based upon the other senses to try to make it all fit together. And it actually modifies what you experience. One of the most dramatic examples of this is called the McGurk effect. Have you guys ever heard this?
Yeah. The ba, yeah. Ba, yeah. Ba, ba.
Yeah. So if right, yeah. So if you look at it, they basically take a video of somebody saying – like fa 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 ba 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 ma ma ma, and so you can see the way their lips are moving, but the audio is just playing the same thing over and over again, like ba 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 ba.
No,
but
that's right.
You will hear fa when you see the lips move that way. What you hear actually changes based upon what you're
Whoa.
Seeing. So like you're
Holy
half
crap.
You're half reading the lips and half hearing it, and then your brain adjusts it to make a match.
Stupid brain.
And the thing is, when you see that, you realize how intensely your brain is stitching together reality by all the input, and you start to get that feeling like you just don't even know what
that's
going on.
That's the whole point. You don't.
I think a lot of people, mostly people who don't have to wear glasses, don't realize how much we read lips in order to understand what people are saying.
No, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think this is just part of that broader phenomenon of just, you know, what you taste is altered by what you see, because that's your brain works that way. It actually is altering what you taste. It's not just the suggestibility of it. All right, Evan, tell us about Who's That Noisy?
Well, I'll play for you last week's Who's That Noise, and then we'll have a little discussion about it. So here we go.
You see, every day, is that good or bad for your business with him hanging around?
Don't think it makes any difference. Kind of like my chiropractor.
So any of my fellow skeptics watch Law and Order at any point in their lives?
That did sound suspiciously like Ice-T.
Yeah, I've seen almost every video because my wife is obsessed with that show. I watch all of them.
This particular one came from the episode called Skate or Die. May 20th, 2009 was the air date.
I'm not complaining about having to watch all of those. I'm just saying, you know, I've seen all of them.
There were two voices in that clip. One was a store clerk being portrayed by unknown actor, and the other was by detective, who was portrayed by Anthony Anderson, actor Anthony
Anderson.
You know,
some of the episodes are actually pretty good, but some of them are just
Ice-T
bad.
Ice-T is on the other one.
You know, like, just, like, start over.
Yeah, and there's so many of them, and boy, how long has it been? 20, it's got to be 20 years, at least.
Oh, more than that, I think.
That's,
you know what, every time I watch original. One of those, I'm always waiting for the chung-chung.
It's iconic. It is.
Yeah.
You know, they use that same sound effect in Law and Order UK.
Yes.
Chunk chunk.
We've watched a couple episodes of those.
Law and Order UK, SUV, SVU, whatever.
SUV.
Something else.
And the ten other spinoffs. But that clip was submitted by our good friend and fellow skeptic Tim Farley. We all know Tim is running the website, whatstheharm.net.
Indeed.
There's lots of harm. That's what we've discovered.
Unfortunately.
So it's an excellent time to remind our listeners to go, and if you haven't checked it out in a while, check out whatstheharm.net. Tim does excellent work over there.
Yeah, I always link to that site now. It's great because I can just, whenever I talk about the harm that's done by pseudoscience in medicine, which is often. Mm-hmm. It's nice to be able to just link to, you know, a repository of anecdotal but still evidence about harm that does get done.
Well, we get a lot of emails, and people actually, you know, that's a great name for the website because people, what's the harm? I mean, that's what basically the default thing is when people are trying to defend this stuff. And you're like, what's the harm? Go to whatstheharm.com and take a look.
This week we have co-winners. I'm awarding it to a pair of people who one chimed in over email and another on the message boards. And in fact, the same person who sent us an email also chimed in right shortly after on the message board. So first of all, thank you, Dave, just Dave from the message boards. Who got the episode correct, and also for Kyanetics from the message board, who sent us an email also saying that it was from a Law and Order episode. So I'm awarding it to both of those listeners this week. Very good job.
Yeah. That's good work, boys.
Evan, what do you got for this week?
For this week, we have something a little bit out of the ordinary. Who's that noisy? Okay.
That's me falling down the stairs at TAM last summer.
Several times.
In footy pajamas.
You could use that as like a drum beat, like to lay down a rhythm.
You guys know the, what do you call that stupid thing?
The cheese grater?
Where? No.
Cauldron on their head.
No, that stupid thing on TV.
Snuggie.
The Snuggie. Do you know that there's a new
stupid
one out? I won one at my Christmas party last year. It was the camo Snuggie, and like there's a picture of a guy like actually lying down outside fishing on his back wearing a Snuggie. There's a new one out that's like a jumpsuit. It's like the full-on – these are all the clothes you ever need. This is it. They show people like at sporting events and at the movies and like at shopping in the mall. It's like really people are wearing this stuff out now.
Jay, do you want to describe what a Snuggie is for the non-Snuggie people?
Everybody a Snuggie is
it's basically the nastiest, thinnest fleece you could imagine in an assortment of horrible colors.
Wait a minute. Burnt umber or burnt orange is not a horrible color.
And let's just clarify, Snuggie is not paying for this endorsement.
Yeah, this is not an endorsement, by the way. Then what they do is they make a gigantic bathrobe that they want you to wear backwards.
It's a blanket with armholes.
So,
Yeah. Made of fleece.
But wait, blanket.
The new and improved one actually has a pocket for your TV remote because that's all you need to carry.
What about like a beer helmet or something?
That's come separately. Anyway, let's move on. Thanks, Evan. We're going to just do one quick follow-up email question this week. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the BMJ intercessory prayer article where we thought it was serious. Using intercessory prayer retroactively to pray for people who were sick years ago to see if they were better. Then last week we talked about the fact that was in the BMJ Christmas issue, which is filled with articles that are tongue-in-cheek. They're not meant to be taken seriously. And I speculated or had a question about, I wonder how many times those articles get referenced seriously because they are articles, legitimate articles in the peer-reviewed literature, by people not realizing that they're not serious. I got several very helpful responses from listeners. You can track when articles reference another article. And there have been hundreds of references to the BMJ intercessory prayer article, but just the fact that they're being referenced doesn't tell you what is being said about them. However, listener Christopher Morello sent this message recently. Haha, a subsequent review article perhaps poking fun at those believing in the BMJ Christmas articles. And he sends me a link to, and this is the article's in Danish. It's a Cochrane Center review from December 2009. Here's the abstract. We analyzed the scientific impact of systematic reviews and randomized trials published in the BMJ Christmas issues 1997 to 2006. The articles were mostly interpreted correctly as humorous, but the humorous dimension was overlooked with surprising ease. The result from one ironic, absurd trial on the effect of retroactive remote intercessory prayer for patients already dead or dismissed was taken at face value in 12 of 36 of the citing articles, and mortality data was unconditionally included in 3 systematic reviews. Thus, we document a new type of bias in medical research, serious idiopathic loss of lutic irony bias, or the silly bias.
So that also explains the proliferation of onion articles being passed around by great aunts and uncles across the nation.
12 out of 36. That's like almost a third. Right. That's
almost.
I don't feel bad that we got snookered too. But the point, my point was it's contaminating.
Not that they were in very good company.
Well.
So that's, there you go, proof that it's contaminating the legitimate medical literature. Mm. Speaking of getting misinterpreted, this is kind of funny. When I was writing about the water article, remember the water article before?
No.
I mentioned that, I said, you know, this is like surreal, this, you know, regulatory body taking 3 years to decide that water doesn't treat dehydration. I said, it's right out of Brazil, a dark comedic dystopian totalitarian nightmare. You guys know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah. Definitely, yep.
Oh, did people think
I
that
got
you were
an
being
angry
racist?
Email from a Brazilian. How dare you say such mean, awful, nasty things about my country?
Well, did you italicize the word Brazil?
No, to his credit, I didn't.
Then it's your
fault. Yeah, I know. I just thought it was obvious from the context, but I explained to him it was the movie, not the country. But I did go back and add a link to the IMDb of the Brazil movie.
But Steve, didn't the director then send you an email about that?
Terry Gilliam?
Nice.
Yeah. I wish.
Yeah. All right.
He's a good skeptic from what I understand.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, let's move on.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and then I challenge my skeptic to sniff out the fake. Everyone ready this week?
My nose is ready.
Yep.
Good.
I'm ready.
Rebecca, I think you were the sole winner last week. Is that correct?
Okay. Yes.
We'll see how you.
I'm going to say
we'll
yes.
See how you do this week. Item number 1: a new study shows that people avoid information about topics about which they are ignorant and yet deem important. Item number 2: researchers have identified a protein that, when taken as a daily supplement, almost triples cardiovascular and muscle endurance in human clinical trials. Item number 3: new research finds that walking through a doorway impairs short-term memory. Hear that? Did I hear Bob sighing in the background there?
I think he did sigh.
But Rebecca was the only winner last week, so Rebecca, go first.
No. I find the idea of walking through a doorway impairing your short-term memory to be wonderful. Like, so wonderful that I'm going to say that that is fact, that has to be a fact. People avoid information. They are motivated to avoid the information on topics that they think are important.
Yes.
I find it odd that people would... I mean, obviously, this is the trick, but why would people avoid information if it's a topic that they have deemed important? Why would they want to avoid information about it if they're ignorant of it, but they feel it's important? That doesn't really make sense. I feel if somebody thinks that something is important, they're going to seek out information about it. So that leaves... a protein that will triple your cardio and muscle endurance. That would be really wonderful. That sounds doable, I guess. That sounds like a nice wonder pill that some big pharma group might be interested in finding. So yeah, I can believe that. I'm going to have to go with, the first one. I think that people would seek out information about a topic if they feel it's important. If they don't feel it's important, then I can see why they would wish to remain ignorant. But otherwise, that doesn't make sense. So,
okay.
I'll go with that one.
Evan?
The one about the study showing people avoiding information about topics. They are ignorant about the topics, but they deem the topic important. I'm not sure what to make of this. I agree in principle that people avoid information about topics which they are ignorant, maybe sort of just as a, in a general sense. It's a little strange. The second one about researchers identifying a protein and tripling cardiovascular and muscle endurance. Wow.
Almost.
Almost triples.
It's a very important clarification.
More than doubles, that's but not quite crazy. Triples. Well, that's a fantastic claim. And I'd like to see some evidence for that, of course.
But
tripling, well, that's the part there that you have to think about. Is it, can it really triple it, a protein? When taken as a daily supplement, you see, I think maybe that's where you're trying to trip us up on this one. The last one about research finding that walking through a doorway impairs short-term memory. Well, I don't know about this one. I would say that you'd find, well, I can only speak for myself because I've had thoughts about this before. I've subconsciously, when I forget something, you know, I'll be on my way to another location remembering to do something. I'll have forgotten what it was. I have to trace my steps back and physically go back to the point, and maybe I'll see something in the environment that will trigger a memory. As far as it's like, oh yeah, that's what I was doing, and then go off and do my task. But I think it has more to do with the change of scenery rather than walking through a doorway, right? The act of walking through a doorway. I'm not sure it's really that. I think it's rather changing from one scene to another. You get diverted, you know, you go out of one room that's playing a radio and another room there's a television, kind of your mind shifts and kind of has this own level, different level of distraction. So maybe it has more to do with the immediate scenery rather than walking through a doorway. But I'm going to go with Rebecca and agree that the one about avoiding the topics of which people are ignorant is the fiction, because I'm having the hardest time kind of grappling with that one, and I'll be very, very interested to hear how the other two come out.
Okay, Bob?
GWR.
Walking through the door impairing short-term memory. Yeah, I can kind of see how that could make sense. When you're walking through a doorway, you're generally walking through, generally I would think that there'd be the smallest thing you go through in the course of a day. And, you know, so I would think possibly, you know, you're just kind of like alert in a sense that you're like, okay, this is like close. I could just see how that would just, how your short-term memory just kind of gets short-circuited. The first one, the avoiding information, that if you have a topic that you clearly think is important, but you're still ignorant about it, I think maybe avoiding it makes you feel better about the reason why you've avoided something that was important, or maybe you're afraid that your preconceived notions will be shattered by actually learning more about it. Obviously, on the surface, this looks like crap, but I mean, I could kind of justify that a little bit. The second one, though, I mean, about the protein that almost tripling cardiovascular and muscular endurance, to me, I mean, I've read some extraordinary things like this, but generally, it would include some sort of genetic engineering, or I can't even really remember something that would have such a dramatic result.
Maybe you walked through a doorway and you forgot.
Yeah, possibly. I'm always reading science news as I walk through doors. But a daily supplement having such a dramatic effect, I mean, God, I hope that's true. That would be amazing. But I'm also having trouble associating a protein that can have that effect. Muscle endurance, I mean, doesn't glycogen play a big role in that to a certain extent? I'm not sure how a protein is going to increase your glycogen stores cardiovascular benefits. I just have to go. That just sounds a little too extraordinary to me. I hope it's true, but I'm going to say that's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Good comments, guys. The one about people not talking about things they think are important but don't know much about. Wow, that's counterintuitive. I think the key here is that they don't know, or they know that they don't know about it, as opposed to people who think they do know a lot about it. That one's interesting, and something about it makes me think that it's true. The second one about the human protein increasing muscle endurance and cardiovascular endurance. And wow, I mean, really? I agree with what Bob said. Like, that just seems like an incredibly tall order just for a protein. I would love it to be true. I just don't think that one's true. And the last one researched about the walking through the doorway. I mean, that one's kind of weird, too. I don't really agree with what Bob was trying to get at there. I mean, I think short-term memory, yeah, when you enter a new environment and you need to observe the new environment that you're in, I think that makes sense, that your brain might be kind of cleaning the slate so you can absorb the new thing that you're looking at, the new area that you're looking at. You know, pay attention. You just walked around a corner. Might be a monster there, type of thing, or you know, a dangerous animal. Sure, that kind of makes sense now that I think about it. So I'd say that one is definitely true, and the one about the protein is the one that's most likely to be false. I will go with Bob.
All right, so we're evenly split between one and two. So you all agree that new research finds that walking through a doorway impairs short-term memory, and that one is science. Very cool science. Yeah.
Science, huh?
Yeah. It is interesting. The experiments were good. They actually controlled for all the other variables. So they compared – they had subjects perform some memory tasks, and then they would either walk a certain distance with the same kind of change of environment. They either pass through a doorway or not pass through a doorway. So they really tried to isolate the passing through the doorway as an isolated variable. They even had another subset where they had – the subjects walk like through like a series of corridors back to where they started from. So they ended up in the exact same environment that they left, but either passing through a doorway or not passing through a doorway. And those who passed through a doorway performed worse on these memory tasks, for short-term memory.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's
this awesome. is the thing that kind of triggered the researchers was the common experience of like walking into a room and then forgetting what you went there to do.
Yeah.
Does that experience reflect some actual phenomenon, or is it just something we notice? And they say, well, maybe there's something real going on here. And I think, Bob and Jay, you guys were kind of addressing the issues that they brought up, that when you passing through a doorway is kind of a trigger for your memory to reset. They say that maybe when you pass through the doorway, it's a change. It sort of triggers a change of situation. And then so you anything that you we're thinking about previously, your brain sort of stores away and moves on to the next thing. It's like it turns the page. It's like, okay, now we're in a new situation. And so it's harder to retrieve something that you were maybe just holding in your short-term memory.
I wonder if that happens in video games too. Like,
walking through a virtual door?
Yeah, like you're in a first-person view maybe. Yeah, and you go through a door.
That's a good question. That would be a good follow-up experiment. See if walking through a virtual door has the same effect.
I don't think there's much of a difference between a video game and doing something real for real to your brain. Yeah. I mean, you're experiencing
but
it.
That's the question, isn't it? So that'd be interesting. That's an interesting hypothesis. But so I thought that was funny.
Oh, it's hysterical, yeah.
People, it's a common experience. You're sort of on autopilot. You get up, you go somewhere, you're like, what the hell am I doing here? What did I come here for? And Evan, what you said actually is supported by other research, that you trace your steps. And then what they found was that your memory for something that you studied is better in the environment that you studied it in, because there are things in the environment that trigger those memories and that are you associate the memories with things in your environment.
Like smells, I've heard people I've heard study tips like burn a certain candle and then bring a candle to class like a weirdo.
Yeah, right. Well, odor, olfactory sense has a strong connection with memory.
Yeah.
So you've all have had that experience where you smell something and it brings you instantly back to, some time or situation that is associated with that odor. And not just the memory, but like the feelings that you have associated with it.
Yeah.
Because there is definitely a very tight association between odor and the amygdala, the emotion centers of the brain. So that was interesting. I guess we'll go back to number one. A new study shows that people avoid information about topics about which they are ignorant and yet deem important. Evan and Rebecca think this one is the fiction. Bob and Jay think this one is science. And this one is science.
Oh, yeah.
Damn baby. It.
Delicious.
Jay.
Delicious. Ready, Bob? Jesus, smacked me right in the face.
So This was
the really sad thing is that I saw this article. I apparently did.
I love when that happens.
On the perpetuation of ignorance, system dependence, system justification, and the motivated avoidance of social political information. Stephen Shepard and Aaron Kay are the researchers. And there's a chain, there's five studies here that they're presenting in this paper, and a chain of phenomena that they're describing. Briefly, what they're saying is that one of the ways that we cope with situations, if we feel that a situation is very complicated, we tend to feel overwhelmed by it. And we therefore, one way to deal with that is to think, okay, well, somebody else is going to take care of this for me. And what they used in their studies as the somebody else was the government. So they used, for example, either economic issues or energy policy or whatever, and they gave people very simple, easy to understand sort of description of, say, new types of energy sources, and then they gave them a really complicated description of the same things. The people who had the complicated descriptions were more likely to say that they trusted the government to handle it. It's as if they're
okay.
saying, well, I'm not at the part yet where that's relevant to the science
all
of
fiction. All right. Fine.
I said five studies. They were not that the
five. All right.
Yeah,
so then on. So then they wanted to find out, okay, so if they feel like they're ignorant of this topic and they're sort of trusting that someone else is going to handle it for them, how will they respond if they're given the opportunity to read information about that very topic? And people avoided information about topics that they felt they didn't have a handle on, that they were ignorant of, but only if they thought it was relevant, if it was important, it was an important issue to them. If it wasn't important, then they were more likely to read the information that was being offered. So the thinking is, the way the researchers interpret this is that they didn't want to read any information that might threaten their faith in the government to handle the issue for them. They right if they because if they read any information that might contradict things or imply that maybe the government doesn't know what they're doing or that would reinforce how complicated and difficult to control it is, that would threaten the comfort that they had established by just outsourcing it to somebody else. So they actively avoided information about topics that they were ignorant about that they thought were important to them.
Fine. I just want to point out that I didn't actively not continue reading that article further than I should have. It was just that I was very busy today.
Yeah, you thought Steve will handle this for me. I don't need to take care of this. So all of which means that researchers have identified a protein that, when taken as a daily supplement, almost triples cardiovascular muscle endurance in human clinical trials, is fiction.
Oh, man, I have mixed feelings on this.
Yeah, it would have been nice if that were true. So the taking a protein as a supplement is a problem because you're just going to turn it into food. You know,
when I'm lifting, I'm coming.
So if you're taking a protein as a drug, you usually have to inject it, not take it as an oral, and not take it orally. And, yeah, it's a little, you know, tripling endurance is pretty extreme. But this is based upon a real and cool study.
Almost.
I don't know if you read the study that I based this on, Bob.
No. This,
but there were several differences. One, the real study was in mice. It only doubled muscle endurance, and it involved tweaking genes, not taking a supplement. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I did. I did see that one, but I didn't connect the dots on that. But, yeah, that one sounded pretty cool, too. But, yeah, this one was just like.
Yeah, so what they did was sweet. That they acted, they changed a regulatory gene, the NCOR1 gene. And this modifies gene expression. So it's essentially they decreased an inhibitory or a suppressing protein, a suppressing gene, and this caused muscle density to double in the mice that they were, even when they were sedentary, and
awesome.
Also increased their endurance. And, Bob, it increased the density of their mitochondria in their cells.
Whoa!
So
that's awesome.
You know, so what about the energy source? That explains why it would have more endurance because they actually have more mitochondria.
Yeah, the article I read just focused on that. It just made you a hell of a lot stronger. Didn't really...
Yeah, but it was also endurance.
Oh
yeah,
man,
and
that's awesome.
That was one of the yeah. Hmm. So yeah, and maybe you know we can develop a drug, for example, based upon this knowledge without having to do genetic engineering. If you could bind to the receptor to inhibit it, then that could achieve the same result as doing the genetic manipulation. Maybe not to the same extent, but still, imagine taking a medication or even taking an injection that is safe and that can cause you to significantly increase your muscle mass and endurance. Of course, you know, the medical applications would be for people who are injured or have muscular dystrophies, or for the, you know, for people who are the old population, you know, sometimes it's hard for older people to hold on to their muscle mass and their muscle function. The joke I was going to make was, yeah, it increases, it doubles your muscle strength and endurance when taken with regular exercise over many
years. Awesome.
Just apparently, like those. Yeah. Like those yeah, it was part of this complete breakfast.
Exactly. The other, Steve, the other cool thing, though, that with the real story was that they tested it and it had a similar effect on, I think, was it mice or voles and nematodes, which
and nematodes, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's pronounced nematodes.
So it shows that it's broadly applicable across
and
many
that's huge.
Species,
that's really
yeah.
huge. I mean, because they're very yeah. distinct creatures.
So hopefully it'll work in people. So you never know how these things are going to pan out, or if they're going to pan out, and you know what all the problems that may ensue. But may just not be just figure out a way to manipulate the system. But it's interesting that it's possible to, you know, by suppressing a receptor or protein, to, you know, double muscle mass and endurance. That's nice.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Good job, Bob and Jay.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, very impressed.
Actually.
With yourself?
Yeah, well, of course. What do you think I'm talking about?
Well, Jade, can you impress us with a quote this week?
I would love to, Steve. Boy, that felt good, didn't it, Bob?
Sure did.
Drop it.
It's magnificent. Okay, so this guy named Mark sends me a pretty damn awesome quote. This guy, Mark from New Zealand. It says that this guy named Stanley Prusiner is the author of the quote, said quote. I looked up the quote, and that is not the author of the quote.
Ooh, false attribution.
Yes. I think the guy that he gave credit to, Stanley Prusiner, he quoted the quote. Somebody else's yeah. quote, okay? Mm-hmm. That's my clarification. I looked it up. And lo and behold, the guy that wrote the quote has an awesome name, which I'm going to so happily shout out in a number of seconds here. And his name is Maurice Polydor Marie Bernard Maeterlinck. Link, something like that. Love it. I love the quote.
Something like that.
The guy's awesome. The quote is, "At every crossroads on the road that leads to the future, tradition has placed against us 10,000 men to guard the past." Maurice was a Belgian playwright, poet, and essayist who wrote in French. He was also awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1911. His name, once again, is, of course, Maurice Polydor Marie Bernard Maeterlinck. Link.
I think Mater he heard Link. That from the grave.
Maeterlinck.
That was a good quote. I really liked that.
Yeah.
We'll call him Mater.
Tomater.
Mater.
All right, thanks,
Steve. Jay. I have a couple of announcements.
And I have a correction. Do you want the correction first or the announcements first?
Yes, give us the correction, Evan. Tell us how you screwed up last week.
Yeah, I screwed up. I did not correctly acknowledge John Aaron and his role that he played in the Apollo 12 mission as far as being able to figure out what was going on when the mission was struck by lightning shortly after takeoff. And it was upon his suggestion, John Aaron's suggestion from Mission Control, throw it into aux, he basically said. But apparently he's a very, he's a brilliant person who's very, very important to the Apollo program, not only for playing a role in the Apollo 12 crisis, but also Apollo 13 crisis. And he should be acknowledged correctly. Thank you to various listeners who sent me information regarding that, and I wanted to get that on the record.
Thanks, Evan. Jay, what do you got for us? What kind of announcements are you talking about?
All right. I have a few announcements. First one is Nexus is coming up April 21 to 22. Yeah, so everyone, you can go to nexus.org. That's NECSS.org to get up-to-date information on the new conference that we're putting out. The new website's coming, but that'll at least give you the save-the-date information. Announcement number two is we did put up all the videos that we produced this year are now up on our YouTube channel. You can see those links on the Facebook page, Skeptics Guide Facebook page, or my Facebook page, and don't be afraid to friend us. Another quick announcement, please send me more quotes. I love the quotes that people send in, and I really get great coverage with that, and it helps me, you know, find much better quotes than I'm finding on my own these days. So please do send those in.
And don't forget to go to the SGU store, buy our extra uncut episodes, buy our swag, go to skepticalrobot.com, and just, you know, support the SGU because you like us. I'm assuming.
Good plug, good plug.
Thanks. I'm always good with the plugs.
I really miss my calling, everybody. Everybody just pat yourselves on the back.
You got anything to add, Rebecca? You're going to quit while you're ahead?
All right,
well, thanks for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Really.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.